topic that that we chose is a difficult one. I hope that at least when you leave here tonight, you have a little bit more of an idea of how to deal with it. And I hope that the Divrei Torah will be a schus for Refuah Shleima, for Hana Rasha Bas Yitaratza, and that the Rabbanu Shel Olam changed the Tov from Machalot to a Samech, Somech Hashem Lechol HaNoflim, to Machlis. This question, why do bad things happen to good people, was asked by none other than Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, after the Ribbono Shel Olam agreed to forgive the Jewish people of the Chet HaEgel, so he saw that it was an opportune time to ask things that he didn't ask before. And one of them was, Hodieni noez drachecho, let me know your ways. And Chazal say what he meant to say was, Loma yesh tzadik v'ralo, tzadik v'tovlo. Why are there tzadikim who suffer and tzadikim who prosper? Rosh v'tovlo, rosh v'ralo. Wicked people who prosper and wicked people who suffer. Now on the surface, Moshe Rabbeinu asked too many questions. Because if you'd ask me what bothers me, only two of those things bother me. Only why do tzaddikim suffer and why do rishoyim prosper? But Moshe Rabbeinu also asked, why are the tzaddikim who prosper and rishoyim who suffer? That doesn't bother me, that makes sense. So why did Moshe Rabbeinu ask all four? So I think the real answer is that if we see that in this world all tzaddikim would suffer and all rishoyim would prosper, we would just have to realign our understanding of what this world is all about. This world is a world where tzaddikim suffer and rishoyim prosper. But since we see there are tzaddikim who do prosper, then why are there tzaddikim who suffer? And there are rishoyim who suffer, then why are there rishoyim who prosper? But I think I want to give you a different answer. The Telzer Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal, Rabbi Yosef Yehuda Leib Bloch, says the following. Explains a pasuk that we say many times a week on Shabbos. Ishbar lo yeda uchesil lo yovin ezos. An ignorant person doesn't know, and a fool doesn't know this. He says there's no sin in being ignorant. We're all ignorant of many, many things. An ignorant person doesn't know. A ksil, a fool, that is an insult, to be a fool. What's a fool? I'll give you an example to what he says. Imagine a senator in America who is responsible for the appropriations of funds to NASA space control. He has to okay every expenditure, and if he doesn't okay it, it doesn't get funded. He doesn't know too much about electronics. He knows bikoshi, how to turn on his transistor radio. Beyond that, very difficult. But he doesn't want anybody to think he's ignorant. So he walks into NASA space control with all of these complicated electronic gadgets, and he walks over to one console and he says, I don't understand why you need this machine, and until somebody explains it to me, you're not getting funded. That's a fool. Everything else in the room you understand inside out except that one machine. You don't understand anything. So admit you don't understand anything. Don't point this thing out as if that's the only thing you don't understand. An ignorant person admits that he doesn't know anything. A fool points one thing. I don't understand the Holocaust. And if God could bring a Holocaust, I don't understand it. And everything else in nature you do understand. You understand why children are born healthy, and you understand all the workings of nature. The only thing that you don't understand is the Holocaust. That's a fool. That's a fool. In all my years as a Rav, no one ever came to me after davening one morning and said, Rabbi, I'm very, very upset. I need you to explain something to me. I woke up this morning. I'm healthy. My wife is healthy. My children are healthy. I'm making a living. I don't understand why God is doing this to me. No one ever asked me that question. Many people ask me the opposite. I'm not well, my wife's not well, my children aren't well, I'm not making a parnosa, why is God doing this to me? We have to admit that we don't understand anything. We don't understand when things are going good, we don't understand when things are going bad. As much as we can understand, we'd like to understand. And there's a mitzvah to understand as much as we can. But not to pick out the one thing, this I don't understand, that's a fool. Ksil or Yovenizos. Moshe Rabbeinu was not a fool. And then Moshe Rabbeinu did not ask only the questions that bothered him. Why are the tzaddikim that suffer and rishoyim that prosper? Moshe Rabbeinu said, Rabbeinu Shalom, I don't understand anything. I don't understand why tzaddikim prosper either, and I don't understand why rishoyim suffer either. So I'd like you to explain everything to me as much as I can understand. Please let me understand. And there's a mitzvah to understand. It's in that light that we will speak about this topic tonight. We are not trying to vindicate the Rabbeinu Shel Olam of making tzaddikim suffer, because it bothers us. But we're trying to understand what we can about Darchei Hashem as much as we can. All the gamut. And if we can understand, then sometimes understanding the Rabbeinu Shel Olam as much as we can brings us closer to Him, and the closer we become, the more the tzoras and the negative things in the world disappear. We start with a Gemara in the beginning of Maseches Avodah Zarah. The Gemara says that in the future God is going to take a Sefer Torah and put it in His arms, figuratively speaking, and He's going to say, whoever fulfilled what it says here, come and get your reward. And all the nations of the world are going to gather together to claim their reward. And the Rabbeinu Shalom is going to split them up nation by nation, and the Romans are going to come in first. And God is going to say to the Romans, what did you do that you want to be rewarded for? They're going to say the following. We built a lot of marketplaces, and we made a lot of bathhouses, and we amassed a tremendous amount of gold and silver, and everything we did that the Jewish people should learn Torah. The Rabbeinu Shalom is going to say to them, you built your shopping centers for immoral purposes, you built your bathhouses for your own pleasure, and the gold and silver, that's mine. Li ha-kesef, li ha-zov. You have anything else to claim, say it, if not, out. And he calls them fools. Shotim sheba'olam. You're a bunch of fools. Next come in the Babylonians, say similar things. We made a lot of wars, we collected a lot of everything we did that the Jewish people should learn Torah. The Rabbeinu Shalom calls them fools, throws them out. The Brisker Rav Zatzal asks two questions here. I'm going to add a third question. He asks, how did the Goyim have such a chutzpah, standing face to face with the Rabbeinu Shalom, to say such a preposterous lie? That everything they did that the Jewish people should learn Torah. And if they're already lying, why doesn't the Rabbeinu Shalom call a spade? Call them liars, not fools. You're liars. Why doesn't he call them liars? I want to add another question. Why does the Rabbeinu Shalom give them two different answers? When it comes to the bathhouses and the shopping centers, the Rabbeinu Shalom said, you didn't do it for the Jewish people. You did it for your own selfish purposes. When it comes to the money, you could have said the same thing. And the gold and silver that you amassed, you also amassed for your own purposes. Why there did he change the answer and say, Li akesef, li azov, the gold and silver is mine? You could have said that about the bathhouses and the shopping centers too. Why two different answers? In order to explain this Gemara a little bit differently than the Brisker Rav does, but more to our purpose, start with a Chovos HaLevavos. We know that we have free choice. And we think that we have free reign in this world. That's not the case, says the Chovos HaLevavos. We have free choice, but we don't control the world. We can choose right or wrong, but we can't guarantee that we can bring our choice to fruition. And that is pretty much very obvious. A person can decide to do a mitzvah. Now you can decide that he wants to give tzedakah, he's going to give a certain poor person $1,000. He even writes out the check. Puts it under his pillow, the next morning he's going to give this ani $1,000. He made a good choice, it was his choice. But he can't guarantee that he's going to carry it through. He may, rachmanu litzlan, drop dead overnight. He won't be able to give the tzedakah in the morning. The ani may drop dead. The Ani may win the lottery overnight. He won't be an Ani in the morning. He'll be a rich man. The banks may all collapse and the check will be worthless. A million things can happen that are not in his control that he won't be able to bring his choice to fruition. Same thing goes for bad choices. Person decides he's going to murder somebody. Gets the gun ready, puts it under his pillow. Next morning he's going to murder a person. He may drop dead overnight. Can't murder anybody anymore. The man he wants to murder may drop dead. He can't murder a dead man. The gun may misfire. A million things. He may get in an accident on the way to the murder scene. A million things can happen that he's not in control of. Says the Chovas HaLevavos, we control our choices. We don't control what comes from those choices. We can't control bringing our choices to fruition. And therefore we get rewarded and punished basically for the choice. Whether we can fulfill it or not is up to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Sometimes the Ribbono Shel Olam permits a person to carry out his good choices. That's called Megagel and Schus Al Yedei Zakai. The Ribbono Shel Olam permits good things to happen from good choices. And sometimes the Ribbono Shel Olam says, I don't want that to happen. I don't want this army to get that tzedakah. And he doesn't permit you to bring it to fruition. But you get rewarded for the good thought. And if the Ribbono Shel Olam knows that you would carry through for sure a bad thought, you get punished for that too. Even though we know that Machshava Roy, Nakadosh Baruch Hu Mitzav for Lemaisa, God doesn't punish us for bad intentions. If it doesn't come to fruition, that's only where there is a doubt, there's a place to give us a benefit of the doubt that we wouldn't have carried it out. But if it's not like that, that it's for sure, then you get punished for that too. The Iker reward and punishment is on our decisions. Whether we can bring it to fruition and realize it is up to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Okay, so everything that happens in this world happens because the Ribbono Shel Olam wants it to happen. Good or bad. Good decisions, bad decisions. Sometimes the Ribbono Shel Olam wants that bad decision. He wants that person murdered. And he'll let the person murder him. He'll get punished for it. He made a bad decision. But the Ribbono Shel Olam will use his bad decision to fulfill his ends, his aims. That's called Megagel and Chov Al Yedei Chayev. Sometimes the Ribbono Shel Olam brings things that are negative through negative people's negative choices. If that's the case, then nothing happens in this world that's not Ratzon Hashem. Nothing. Even what people make a decision, in the end is Ratzon Hashem. It's God's will, whether it actually comes to fruition or not. And we have a big problem with that. Because we have another rule. Kol ma da'ovid min shmaya letavavid. Everything the Ribbono Shel Olam does is for the good. Now, we have the same problem really, right? If everything the Ribbono Shel Olam does for the good, without this Chovas HaLevavos. But not as bad. Right? Usually insurance companies blame God for hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes. Those are acts of God. They don't believe in God for anything else, but when it comes to that, they are big maminim that these are acts of God and therefore they are not responsible to pay. But what people do, that's not acts of God, that's people. But according to what we're saying now, it's not the case. Even what people choose to do, if the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't want them to carry it out, it won't happen. And if he wants them to carry it out and he lets them carry it out, it's for a good reason. And it's all for the good. That means what people do, even their bad decisions, and wreak injustice on other people, is all for the good. We'll discuss in a few seconds how that works out. In any case, nothing happens in this world, at least according to the Chovas HaLevavos, and that is pretty much the accepted hashkafa by Gedolei Yisrael, even though there is another opinion, which we're not going to confuse you with now. But according to the Chovas HaLevavos, which is pretty much the accepted opinion of Gedolei Yisrael, this idea, everything that happens, even what human beings do, is ultimately Ratzon Hashem. That means that nothing happens in this world that the Ribbono Shel Olam permits to happen that doesn't fit his plan for the world. What is God's plan for the world? Ultimately, that Mashiach should come and the world should reach its completion. What's the purpose of Mashiach, says the Rambam? That the Jewish people should be able to sit and learn Torah and observe the Torah to the most ideal circumstances and environment. When the Goyim come at the end of the world and they look back, what are they going to see? That everything they did, that God permitted them to be successful, somehow fit his plan. What was his plan? That the Jewish people should learn Torah. Mashiach should come. So they're not liars. They're not liars at all. They're saying 100% the truth. We built bathhouses. We built marketplaces. We amassed money. And you know what? It all was for the sake that the Jewish people should learn Torah. So they want to jump and get their reward. So the Rabbanu Shlomo doesn't call them liars. It's true. But you're a bunch of fools. You intended for your bad purposes. I made it work out for the good. I'll get the reward, not you. You're fools to think that you'll get the reward for what I made it work out for the good. That's the Gemara. And therefore, I think it answers the other question too. It's ludicrous to think that every bathhouse the Romans made, or every shopping center, somehow brought Mashiach closer. What did it do? It generated a society, an economy, that helped to oil the wheels of progress. So they created Kesef and Zov and an economy. That's what the Rav Amishram said. These things you did for your own purpose. It worked out to create progress. Kesef and Zov, I made it work out like that, not you. You're foolish to think that you'll be rewarded for that. In any case, bottom line, everything that happens in this world, even things that are orchestrated by human beings, are Ratzon Hashem. And everything that happens in the world is for the good. Now, how does that work out? There are a lot of things in this world that seem to be really, really terrible. A suicide bomber, Rahman Litzlan, gets on a bus and blows up, right, 100 innocent men, women, and children. The Rabbanu Shalom is the one, ultimately, who allowed him to do that. Because if he didn't want him to do it, he could have stopped him. He could have made the bomb blow up before he got on the bus. He could have made the bomb not blow up. He could have made nobody get on the bus. But he didn't. He permitted it to happen. And if the Rabbanu Shalom permits it to happen, that means it's for the good. How could that be? How could something so terrible be for the good? How could the Holocaust be for the good? Right? It's mind-boggling. Well, the basic answer to that is not that we can understand it, but at least we can have an inkling of what we don't understand. Reb Shraga Feivel Mendelovitz, that's out. The Menahel of Torah Vadas about 100 years ago almost, 90 years ago. The developer of Torah Masorah. So he said the following. The Pasuk says in Tfilas Chana, Ein Tzur Kelokeinu. There is no rock like Hashem. The Gemara says, Al Tikre Tzur El Tzayar. Don't read rock, but artist. Sayar. Ein Sayar Kelokeinu. There is no artist like Hashem. And the Gemara explains why God is the ultimate artist. Says Rav Shraga Feivel, once the Chazal compared the Rabbanu Shlom to an artist, we can take that comparison a little further. And he says like this. If you take a kindergarten child and you tell her to draw a picture of a person standing in front of them, what is she going to do? She'll draw a circle for a head, a line down for a body, two lines out for arms, two lines down for legs, two dots for eyes, dot in the middle for a nose, big smile, and you're finished. And you know exactly what she's drawing every step along the way. Now go tell Rembrandt to draw the same picture. So you give Rembrandt a canvas, and he dabs some red paint over here and black paint over there. Somebody who knows nothing about art will say to Rembrandt, Mr. Rembrandt, you just ruined this canvas. Red paint, black paint. I'll get you another canvas, start with the circle, and let's get started. You know what Rembrandt will say? This painting's going to take me 6 months. If you have any questions, don't ask them now. Wait till I finish the painting, and then you'll see how everything fits in. What's going to be when the painting's finished? The red will be for contrast. The black is for a shadow. Everything will fit perfectly into the painting. But if you don't see the whole painting, you see it only as it's being produced, you have a lot of questions. And things appear to be destructive, which in the end fit into the painting perfectly. Says Rav Shraga Feivel, the Rabbanu Shel Olam is the ultimate artist. He's painting a panorama of history. And we're in the middle of the painting, and we have a lot of questions. Black blotches and red blotches. How come this is happening and that's happening? But if we could see the whole picture, how everything fits in, and the whole picture is not just this world, the whole picture is eternity beyond this world, then we see how everything fits in perfectly to God's plan, and everything really is for the good. Imagine the following scene, to make it more understandable. You walk in to a room and you see a masked man with a knife ready to cut off somebody's leg. So you assume this is a terrorist attack and you want to be a hero. So you knock out the masked man and drag the victim to safety, expecting a tremendous thank you. The victim looks up at you and says, "Why did you do that? Why did you burst into the operating room and knock out my doctor and drag me out of the operating room? My doctor said I have gangrene, and if he doesn't amputate my leg immediately, I'm going to die. Why did you knock out the doctor and take me out of the operating room? What you thought was an act of cruelty was really an act of mercy, but you didn't see the whole picture. Had you understood the whole picture, you would have understood that this is an act of mercy. It's not an act of cruelty." But that's what happens when you don't see the whole picture. The Chafetz Chaim says very, very cutely an idea that brings this out. He says there's a pasuk that we say every day, three times a day, which has no problems hashkafically. Shomer Hashem eskolu avov, HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects all those that he loves, v'eskol harishoyim yashmid, and he destroys all the rishoyim. No problem with that pasuk at all. What happens if you never heard that pasuk, and you walked into shul one day late, and you know what you heard people saying with great kavana? Eskolu avov, v'eskol harishoyim yashmid. All those that he loves and all the Rishoyim, God's going to destroy. Hey, that's not fair. Why would God want to destroy all the people he loves? And you walk out perplexed. Or, you never heard that pasuk, and you leave shul early. You know what you hear? Shomer Hashem is kol ha'avav, is kol Rishoyim. God is going to protect all those that he loves and all the Rishoyim. That doesn't make sense. Why would God want to protect all the Rishoyim? Says the Chafetz Chaim, we come late, and we leave early from this world. So we only hear a half a pasuk. And we have big questions. Why is the Rebbeinu Shel Olam protecting the wicked and why is he punishing the tzaddikim? If we'd come on time and leave on time, if we'd see the whole picture from beginning to end, we'd see that it all fits in to a plan and it's all for the good. But we don't. We see a very small part of the picture, and when you see a small part of the picture, you see it very distorted. I remember years ago, I think it was in the 1970s, there was a terrible plane crash in Chicago. It was the worst air disaster in America up till that time. 200-300 people were killed. A plane took off, and one of the engines just fell off the wing, and it plummeted, and within a minute and a half, that was it. I remember I was in Miami, and I was reading the Miami Herald, and there they had some stories about people who were on the plane, who were not on the plane, or whatever. I remember one story made an impression on me. There was a woman who did not have a reservation on this plane. She was on standby. But she had to get to a family reunion. And if she missed the plane, she'd miss the family reunion. And she really wanted to be there. So every 2 minutes, she would go to the ticket counter. And she would say, "Can I get on?" And they would say, "Lady, you have to wait until right before we close the gate. And we'll see if people don't show up. And you're the first one on the standby list. You can get on. If not, you can't get on. So have some patience, just sit down, and right before we close the gate, we'll let you know." She didn't have any patience. Every 2 minutes she was going, "Can I get on? Can I get on?" There was a businessman who had a reservation on that plane. And he thought to himself, "Look, if I miss this business meeting, they'll just reschedule it. It'll be a little inconvenient, but this woman really wants to get on the plane. So I'm going to do her a favor." He goes over to her, and he says, "Look, take my seat on the plane. I'll take your standby number. If I get on the plane, fine. If not, so they'll reschedule the meeting. But you really want to get to your family reunion, take my seat." At that moment, the man thought that he is really doing a chesed to somebody else and inconveniencing himself for the sake of someone else. And this woman thought, this is a really lucky day. How long did it take before you saw the whole picture and you realized this man did himself a tremendous favor, and this woman never made it to that family reunion, probably to a different family reunion, but not that one. So if you don't see the whole picture, and we never see the whole picture, you see things in a very distorted way. The Chafetz Chaim says that we think, therefore, that when the world will reach its completion, and we'll see the whole picture, we're going to need a lot of explanations of why all these terrible things happened that we saw as terrible, how they fit into the picture. Rembrandt is going to have to explain the picture and all the nuances. And it may take weeks, months, years. Says the Chafetz Chaim, no, it's not going to take long at all. And there's a precedent. There were 10 brothers that had a lot of questions. They went down innocently to Egypt to buy food like everybody else. They're accused of being spies. All of a sudden they're thrown into prison. They're sent back to get their little brother. The little brother is framed. One thing after, they find their money in their sacks. Everything is a question. They figured someday somebody's going to explain all of this to us. It may take hours to explain each thing. How long did it take to explain everything? Two words. Ani Yosef. That was it. When Yosef said, Ani Yosef, then he said, now we understand everything. So too says the Chafetz Chaim, one day HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to say, Ani Hashem. And he's going to reveal himself to the world. And once he says those two words, there's not going to be any more questions. Everybody will say, now I know why this happened, and this fit in, and this fit in. I'll see the whole picture, will be able to understand. My wife, she'd be well, once asked me a question at the Shabbos table, years ago, at Parshas Miketz. Usually, Parshios end on an upbeat. Chazal like to end things happy. Happy ending. Miketz is an exception. Parshas Miketz ends with Binyamin being taken back to Mitzrayim, being at least made into a slave, and we don't know what's going to happen. Right? It's like a cliffhanger. Tune in next week and find out what happened to Binyamin. And next week, within very few psukim, we have, what's it called? We have Binyamin, Yosef revealing himself to the brothers, and everything comes out okay. Why didn't Chazal extend Miketz one more column and end with Yosef revealing himself to the brothers? A nice happy ending. Why does it have to end like that? I told her that based on what the Chafetz Chaim says, that's exactly the reason. Because we learn from here that you may not see how everything fits in this week. You may have to wait till next week, but you should know that eventually it's going to work out for the good. But you won't see it today, or this year, or this world, maybe the next world. But that's what the lesson of Miketz is. We're going to end with something perplexing, but next week it's all going to work out. And that's what Chazal say. Bayom hahu v'hoyo Hashem l'melech al kol ha'aretz. Bayom hahu yiyeh Hashem echad u'shmo echad. The Gemara asks in Psachim, and God is not one now. Only bayom hahu, then he'll be one. And now he's not one. Only then will his name be one. Now his name's not one. Says the Gemara, no. Lo ka'olam hazeh olam haba. This world is not like the next world. In this world, on things that appear good, we make hatova meiti. And on things that appear bad, we say, dayin ha'emes. In the next world, everything is atova meitiv. Says the Tzlach, it doesn't mean that in the next world there's no bad. Everything is good, in this world there's good and bad. Because that has nothing to do with the bracha. It has to do with the fact that there's no bad in the next world. And there is bad in this world. He says what it means is the following. In this world, on things that appeared to us bad, we made a dayin ha'emes. What appeared good, we say atova meitiv. In the next world, looking back, we'll see that all the things that we made a dayin ha'emes on really are atova meitiv. They really are the good for the good. So there's only one bracha. And that is the answer that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to Moshe Rabbeinu. V'ra'isa achorai uponai lo yero. The Rabbanu Shalom told Moshe Rabbeinu, you want the answer? The answer is when everything will reach its end and you'll look back, the Ra'isa Achorai, you'll look in retrospect, there's no more questions. But Panai, looking ahead, when you're in the middle of the picture, I can't give you answers. I can only give you an answer when you look back and see the whole picture. Shem Shon Fel Hirsch says the answer is contained in a different pasuk. In order to understand what he says, I'll tell you a little story. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Meisels, the Weitzner Rav, those who come from Chicago, anybody know the Weitzner Rav, was a choshev Rav in Chicago in the end of his life. He was a Rav in Auschwitz. He was taken to Auschwitz, and he wrote a sefer after being liberated called Mekadshei Hashem. It's a collection of Divrei Torah from Rabbonim who died in the Holocaust, who were killed by Kiddush Hashem. He has an introduction. And he writes some stories that happened to him in Auschwitz. And one of the stories goes like this. One day, a SS guard came and said, the commandant of the camp wants to see you immediately. So he knew if he resisted, he'd be shot on the spot. He had no choice. And he understood that when the commandant of the camp wants to see you immediately, it means you're going to be executed. So he said vidui, took off his boots and gave them to one person, his coat he gave to another person, his food ration to a third person, and he went, figuring that if I don't resist, at least I'll live another 15, 20 minutes till we get to the camp office. Comes in, the commandant says, Herr Rabiner, sit down. Something's bothering me, I gotta ask you a question. Sits down. He says, you Jews believe in God. And your God is permitting we Nazis to do terrible things to you Jews. Don't you have any questions on your God? Don't you want to ask him why he's letting us do all these things? Doesn't it bother you? Rav Meisels looked him in the face and he said like this. He said, when I was a little boy in Cheder, our Cheder Rebbe told us not to ask too many questions on God. Because if you ask questions, he's going to invite you up to answer them, and you don't want to be invited up so fast. So since then, I don't ask questions on God, because I really don't want to be invited up that quickly. The Nazi laughed and let him go. Says Rav Shamshon Fol Hirsch, along the same lines. That's what the Rav Shamshon told Moshe Rabbeinu. Hine makom iti. Moshe, you have questions. Tzadik v'ralo, Rosh v'tovlo. There's a place up here, from my perspective, where there's no questions. You want to come up here and see it from my perspective? Gesunter Heid. But if you want to stay down there and see it from your perspective, there are no answers. Here there aren't any questions, down there there aren't any answers. Okay, I've convinced you that this is true, that everything that happens is for the good, except that we don't see the good because we don't see the whole picture. Okay? I'll tell you one more story, and then I'll show you that what I told you up until now is absurd. I'll answer it. But if you don't understand the question, everything that I said, if you went home and thought for a minute, you'd have the same question I'm going to tell you. And it's a very serious question. Let me tell you first a Pardes Yosef story. Don't know if it's a true story, it's just a marshal. It's a story the Pardes Yosef says along the same lines, but the what you can deduce from this story makes everything here that I said absurd. The story goes like this. There was a city that was experiencing a tremendous tzara, the worst tzara in its existence. There was a tzaddik in that city who was known for his power of prayer. When he said Tehillim, the results were immediate. Every time there was a tzara in the city, they went to this tzaddik, he davened, and everything was okay. The Rav of the city went to this tzaddik who was dying. And he said, we know that tzaddikim are greater after they leave this world than they were when they entered this world. The city is experiencing the worst tzara it ever had. I want you to promise me that when you die and you go to the next world, the first thing you do is go before the Ribbono Shel Olam and beg that tzara goes away. And the tzaddik promised, and he died. A week went by, the tzara got worse. 2 weeks, even worse. The Rav is perplexed. He promised me that he would go before the Ribbono Shel Olam and beg him that this tzara goes away. 2 weeks later, the tzaddik comes to the Rav in a dream. And he says, I know that you're very troubled, why I didn't keep my word. He said, but you should know, from my perspective up here now, what's happening to the city is the best possible thing that could happen to it for eternity. I can't daven that good things go away. You see it as bad, you daven, but I can't daven. I can't daven that good things go away. From my perspective up here, it's all good. Okay, what's the question? Then why do we daven? Why did you say Tehillim over here? Don't we believe what I told you? That everything's for the good, even things that look bad, but eternally that's the best thing that could be. So why do we bother davening? You know, I'll tell you what it's like, if you want to really hear how serious the question is. Imagine a person in the hospital, and they need a very painful, invasive operation. Doctor examines them, and he says the following. If they have the operation, they will live another 50 happy, healthy years for sure. How do I know? I made up the marshal. I can make up the marshal any way I want. For sure. No shy. If they don't have the operation, They will die in 2 hours, for sure. Black and white. The person doesn't like pain. The operation will be very painful, but it's definitely going to give that person 50 happy, healthy years. The person says to the doctor, "Doctor, please don't give me the operation. It's going to hurt. It's going to take time for me to recuperate. I don't like pain. Please don't give me the operation." If you were the doctor, would you listen to the person? What if he begged you and begged you? Would you listen to him? No. If you were, you're a murderer. You know, the person, he doesn't understand. This is the best thing that could be for him. It's going to hurt, but it's for his good. You'd give him the operation knowing you're giving him 50 happy, healthy years instead of letting him die in 2 hours. If that's the case, then why do we daven? And why does the Rabbanu Shalom listen to us? Because we're stupid? Rabbanu Shalom, person sick, comes to the Rabbanu Shalom, Refa'enu Hashem, God, I'm sick, please make me well. Why does the Rabbanu Shalom turn around and say, I know you're sick. I made you sick. Nothing happens in this world that's not for me. I made you sick. And I made you sick for a good reason. So what are you chepping me? So why would the Rabbanu Shalom want to take away something good? Because we don't understand. Because we daven. Not much like the case in the hospital. So what are we daven for? Why don't we just say, Rabbanu Shalom, I know that everything you do is good. And this is probably for the good. I don't see it because I don't see the whole picture. You know the whole picture. It's all for the good. So thank you. Keep me sick. Make me more sick. Whatever. What? Why do we daven? I didn't come here to convince you not to daven. So there's an answer. But you have to know what the answer is. The answer is that my marshal is not a good marshal. You have to amend the marshal in the following way. Add another dimension. So back to the hospital. Doctor examines the patient and says that she needs a very painful, invasive operation, but the operation will guarantee 50 happy, healthy years. Don't have the operation. She's going to die within 2 hours. However, says the doctor, it's a shame that her body is so weak. Because since her body is so weak, she won't be responsive to the bitter medicine I have that could accomplish the same thing as the operation. Same thing. Except her body's too weak for that. If she could just exercise and strengthen her body, I could get away with giving her bitter medicine instead of an operation. And not only that, if she even exercises more, I have some sweet medicine that can accomplish the same thing as the operation and the bitter medicine, but your body has to be stronger. The patient hears this. The doctor goes away, and she starts to do sit-ups, push-ups in the bed, right? Hang yourself from the thing above the bed. Doctor comes back in an hour, and he says, hey, her body is much stronger now. I don't have to give her the operation anymore. I can give her the bitter medicine. At this point, is the operation good for her? No. Was it good for her in the first situation? Yeah. Situation changed. What changed? The doctor didn't change his mind. The doctor wanted to do what's good for this person. When your body's weak, what's good for you is the operation. When it gets a little bit stronger, what's good for you is the bitter medicine. When it gets even stronger, what's good for you is the sweet medicine. What changes the patient's condition? We can sometimes make ourselves sick spiritually, or for a million other reasons could be. And what's good for us is something that appears to us to be very, very painful and very negative. But it's not. It's something that will guarantee eternity. But that's only necessary because of the condition the person's in. But if the person's condition can change, then what's good will change also. You don't need the operation. Now the bitter medicine can accomplish the same thing. Tefillah does not change God's mind. We're not chepping the Rabbanu Shalom, change your mind. The Rabbanu Shalom did it, it was for the good. It changes the condition of the person who's davening. Lehispalel, says Rav Sham Shufel Hirsch, is hispael. It's reflexive. It affects you. It doesn't affect the Rabbanu Shalom's mind. It doesn't change his mind. The condition changed. The doctor was consistent. He knew condition A, operation. Condition B, bitter medicine. Condition C, sweet medicine. What changed was the condition. So tefillah, some people say that's why we shuckle when we daven. It's spiritual exercise. You exercise, you strengthen yourself, you change. And it's only one thing out of many. Anything that could change the condition, Torah, mitzvahs, shinui makom, shinui Hashem, that's why we try to make changes. And if you change the situation in the right way, then it may be that what's good for that person will change and be able to happen in a sweeter way. Everything in this world is for the good, but it's not always sweet. Sometimes the good has to come with a very painful operation, and sometimes that operation means a person has to die in this world. Because what's good ultimately is what's eternal, what's in the next world too. But the good can happen in a sweet way, or the good can happen in a bitter way. Davening helps to change the condition where the good can happen in a sweet way. It doesn't have to happen in a bitter way, because the condition changed. And that's why on Rosh Hashanah, we wish each other a Shana Tova Umasuka, a good and sweet year. Every year is good. Everything's good. But not everything is sweet. So we want the good to be able to come in sweetness and not in a bitter way. There's only one problem with that. I'm probably assume this Noshim Chachmonios that some of you are thinking of this question, but I'll tell you what the question is. Let's go back to the marshal. You'll see very clearly. If that's the case, that tefillah does not change God's mind, but it changes the condition of the person. Let's go back to the hospital. This woman needs a very serious, painful operation, which will give her 50 happy, healthy years. But the doctor says if she's a little bit stronger, she'd get the same 50 happy, healthy years with bitter medicine or sweet medicine. I'm standing by the bed of this person, and I say, Doc, you know, she's really weak. She can't even exercise her fingers. But I'm her best friend. And I have a gym at home. I promise you, I'm going home now, and I'm going to exercise for her. So don't give her the operation. Don't give her the bitter medicine. The next hour, I'm really intensely exercising, and I'm going to put her name on the wall. I am exercising for the sake of so-and-so. So take my exercise, and don't give her the operation. Will it help? So what's the obvious question? I understand then how you can daven for yourself. You change. How you daven for somebody else? There are a few answers to that. I'm going to tell you one, maybe two. One should be enough. Tell you another story. When I was a youngster, I couldn't swallow pills. I gagged on them. There are a lot of people like that in this world. At least I convinced myself that there are, that I wasn't the only one. And in those days, there wasn't too many options. They didn't have too many liquid varieties of solid medicine. So my parents had to crush the medicine and put it in my juice or in my cereal or whatever. One of my sons, when he was about 5 years old, had the same problem. Only he was lucky because already science and medicine had advanced and they had a lot of liquid varieties to solid medicines made it easy for him. One time, though, he had an infected toe and the doctor said that there's only one antibiotic that will cure this specific infection, and it has to be taken by mouth, solid form. There is no liquid form of it. And not only that, it can't be diluted. You have to take it whole. Can't put it in cereal, juice, or anything. It must be taken the way it is. So we called my 5-year-old son over, and we said, Shlomi, you have no choice. Usually we try to accommodate your problem of not being able to take medicine. Baruch Hashem, I outgrew that. I can take 10, 11 pills at a time now. I really graduated. But we told him, look, you're going to have to take this pill. And if you can't, then I'm going to sit on you and open your mouth forcibly and your mother's going to throw the pill down your throat. He said, Tati, this is ridiculous. My toe is infected. What are you bothering my mouth? Put the pill on my toe. I don't mind that. What are you putting it into my throat? What does my throat have to do with my toe? Good question for a 5-year-old. What's the answer? It's not your toe and your throat. It's you. What goes into your throat goes into your digestive system, gets absorbed into your circulatory system, the blood brings it to the toe, and the infection is cured. Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh. All Jews are interrelated. We're not separate people. We're all one entity. And therefore, if there's a change in me, it affects a change in you too. Because we're all separate. We're all connected. And therefore, I can't exercise for you physically, because physically we're different. But we have all one neshama. And what I change can affect a change in you also. And therefore, if there's a change in part of the system, it's a change in all of the system. And I can daven for you, and my change affects a change in you too, because we're all related one to another. So we can daven for other people also. I'll tell you another answer. Yisrael Salanter explains the following pasuk. It says a problem with the pasuk. Atzur tamim palo ki chol drachad mishpat. God is perfect. Everything he does is perfect because everything he does is just. He says, what's the big deal that the Rebbeinu Shlomo, everything he does is just? We're supposed to be just too. We're supposed to do everything just with justice also. So why is that something that is specific to the Rebbeinu Shlomo, that all those ways are just? He says the following. I'm not going to say exactly what he said. I'm going to tell you a marshal that... don't blame him for the marshal. Imagine a man, okay, guy is basically a Shomer Shabbos, a firm person, but he has a little quirk in his personality. He works in a factory, and they give him off for lunch, and he gets bored. And the only way he can break his boredom is by going to the nearest McDonald's and shooting all the goyim there in cold blood, men, women, and children. That's how he gets out of his boredom. And he's done this a few times. I killed hundreds of people in cold blood. And they caught him. They bring him before a judge. The judge says, do you regret what you did? He says, no, I'm really bored and I really have to do this. Would you do it again? Oh yeah, sure, I'd do it again if I get bored. Right? I think that everybody would agree, unless you belong to the ACLU, that what would be justice is to give this person a death penalty. He doesn't regret it. He's what's it called, has no remorse. He'd do it again. Give him a death penalty. He's killed hundreds of people. So it's justice to give him a death penalty. However, let me tell you some other facts. He's married to the sweetest tzaddikus, who, when they proposed the shidduch, mentioned all the important things, like does he have a white tablecloth on Shabbos, or does he stack his dishes? They just forgot to mention this one quirk in his personality, like to murder people, right? That wasn't really that important. So she married this guy, and he never hurt her. She didn't even know he was killing people at McDonald's. She'd eaten McDonald's. Right? So he's perfect, perfect husband. He took out the garbage. He was really a nice husband. Right? Never hurt his wife. She didn't even know about this. She's going to be a widow. Is that fair to her? I don't think so. He was the best father. He learned with his kids in all of us who born him. Right? He was a really, really good father. Never hurt his children, and they didn't know anything about McDonald's either. That didn't affect them. Is it fair to them? They're going to be orphans. I don't think it's fair to them. He's the best worker in his factory. If he's executed, the factory owner's going to go bankrupt. Is that fair to him? No. But the judge can't take that into consideration. The only thing he can take into consideration is, how does it affect the person who I am judging? Not the collateral damage. That's human justice. But the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, whenever he meets out justice to anyone, anyone who's affected, anyone, in any way, is only affected because they deserve to be affected. Deserve doesn't mean punished. It means they need that effect. Not more, not less. And therefore, if Rachmana Litzlan, somebody's sick, and it affects me, it hurts me, right? It hurts me because I feel bad. It hurts me because I have to come listen to this rabbi speak. Right? So it hurts me that that person is sick, and I daven, and I change, then I don't need that anymore. Then the situation has to change. It changes the situation sometimes enough, sometimes not enough. It's not cause and effect, but it's definitely one cause amongst many that can change the situation. There's only one more problem with all of this. I understand why we daven, because you can change the situation. If the situation changes, what's good will be something different than what was good in a different situation. What was good in the other situation was an operation. What's good in this situation is sweet medicine. Same result. But the condition makes it whether you can have bitter good or sweet good. Why do we mourn when the situation can't change anymore? That's it. So why do we mourn? Why don't we just accept it and say, Rebbeinu Shlom, it's for the good? Why don't we rejoice at a funeral? Why do we say a Dayan Oemes? Why don't we say a Tova Meitiv? Give you an example. Chanoch lived way back towards the beginning of the world. and he died at the tender young age of 365, when everybody else was living to 900. Ratio-wise, that means he died in his late 20s, comparative today. I'm sure that all of these old people, the 800, 900-year-old great-grandfathers, great-great-grandfathers, were crying at the funeral. Nebuch, 365, didn't even have a chance to really start to get living. Right? They were crying their eyes out at his funeral. But we know why he died at 365. Rashi tells us. Because he was a tzaddik gomer. Perfect tzaddik. And he lived in a generation of Rishoyim, right before the flood. And God knew that if he remained alive, he may be influenced a little bit, and when he dies, he won't be a perfect tzaddik, but an imperfect tzaddik. And because he was a perfect tzaddik when he died, the Rabbanu Shlom took his neshama and made it into the greatest angel that exists. So what happened to Chanoch, the fact that he died at 365, for him was eternally the best thing that could be. Had he died a little bit later, so he would have lived a few more years, he would have been dead 10 times over till today, and he never would have been this angel. So what happened to him was the best thing. So why were the people crying then? Because they didn't know this. But why didn't they say, Rabbanu Shalom, we trust you. And we know that what you do is for the good. And if you took this person young, then it's probably for the best thing for him. And not only for him. The best thing for his wife, for his children, for his employer. Because everything that happens, anybody's affected, is for their good. Like I told you. So why do we mourn? Why don't we dance at funerals? Thank you, Rabbanu Shalom. You did the best thing by making this person die. The truth is that there are people who say that's what you're supposed to do. We're just not on the Madrega. The Gemara says, and the Mishnah says, Kishem shemivarech al hatova, kach mivarech al haroa. Just like you make a brach on good, you make a brach on bad. So the Gemara says, that's true. You don't make the same brach on good and bad. On good you say atova native, on bad you say adayno emes. Ela lekublinu besimcha. You should accept it with simcha. Some people say, that's what it means. When you make the bracha dayin ha'emes, you should do it with simcha. You should be happy when you say a dayin ha'emes. Truth is, as a rabbi, I've been at a lot of funerals. A lot of funerals. Personally, kehila-wise, I never saw anyone say a dayin ha'emes besimcha. I saw them say dayin ha'emes, cry. Even gedolim. So who does this apply to? And not only that, the Ramban says that somebody who doesn't mourn when somebody dies is an achzer. He's cruel. You have to mourn. You have to cry. So what are we saying? Dying of the emes besimcha? What does that mean? Say it besimcha. The truth is that once I was at a funeral where probably they were mekayim this, but not for the same reason. I had to say a hesped many times for people I didn't know. Because people died. They had no relationship, no connection to a shul or to a rabbi. But you know, when people die, they want to be frum. They don't want to be frum when they're alive. But when they're dead, then they want, you know, the best, most frum, fanatic rabbi you can get, because that's going to get my relative into Olam Haba. So the funeral home would call Rabbonim. Here's somebody who had no connection to any shul or whatever, but they want an Orthodox rabbi to do their funeral. Okay. You have to say a hesped. A hesped, you have to say the truth. Can't make up things about a person. It's a lie. It's just a person without a lot of lies. Second of all, the neshama hears it in Olam HaEmes, and it's like rubbing your nails on a chalkboard to the neshama to hear lies. And also the neshama says, all they can say good about me is lies? They can't find anything true to say about me that's good? That's also a terrible thing. So you have to say what's true. Now it's very hard to get to know people after they're no longer here. So how in the world could I say a hesped for somebody that I never saw? So what I used to do is call the family and say to them, either on the phone or meet with them before the Levaya, tell me some good things about your relative and I'm going to put it into a eulogy, into a hesped. And usually they told me, these are not people who are from, they didn't tell me he learned Shas 4 times or whatever, they tell me he had a good sense of humor. Fine, so there's a Gemara that says that people who cheer up other people are B'nai Olam Haba. Right, or he never spoke bad about somebody. Speak about Lashon Hara. Everything could fit. It could fit into the Parsha. Anything could fit into the Parsha. I once had a bris, a levaya, and a chasana on the same day. And I said the same Dvar Torah for all of them. Just fit it into the things, hoping that I wouldn't forget where I was. In any case. So I once had a person who was nifter, an elderly man. He had a wife, he had a sister, and some adult children. I met with them in the funeral chapel before the Levaya. And I said to them, tell me something nice about your husband, your brother, your father. And there's silence for 5 minutes. Finally, they all look at the widow, and she shakes her head and stands up. She says, Rabbi, there is nothing nice to say about my husband. And the sister shakes her head. Yes, I agree. The children shake their head. I was shocked. I didn't know what to do. I just felt that this guy is very lucky he's no longer here with a family like this. I don't remember what I said by that Levaya, but I do remember that I went home that day, bought my children little presents, and said, remember this. That was the only Levaya I ever was at where I think they said, Dayan HaEmes B'Simcha. But not for the reason that we're talking about. So what does that mean? Why don't we, it's hard to be true, if everything I told you is true, everything is for the good, and the condition can't change, so accept it and say, Rabbono Shel Olam, it's for the best, you did the best thing for this person and all the people who are affected, thank you, B'Simcha. And it seems for the Gemara it's what you're supposed to do. But it's not true. No one ever said, Dayan HaEmes B'Simcha. Why not? So let me tell you what I think. We live in this world on two levels. And you have to live on both of these levels. One is called emes, relative truth, and the other one is called emes lamito, absolute truth. I'll give you two examples. You're familiar with the fact that every centimeter, cubic centimeter of air, water, is infested with microorganisms. It's microscopic living things. If you magnify it with an electron microscope a million times, you see monsters flying around the air. Every time you breathe in, you're breathing in these monsters. And they're not kosher. And they're alive. So why don't we have to walk around with a B'nai Brak sifter on our nose and mouth so we don't ingest these monsters that are alive and not kosher? The answer is very simple. Because according to halacha, what you can't see with the naked eye, lo nitna Torah la malachi ashores, doesn't exist for all practical purposes. It's there. That's the absolute truth. But relative to our senses, they don't exist. And kashrus depends on our senses. If you can't see it with the naked eye, it can only be seen with a magnifying glass or with a microscope. Everybody agrees. No one disagrees that you're allowed to eat it. Even if you know it's there. You can be looking through the microscope, the monster is waving at you, and you can inhale and eat them up. No problem, if you want to. So, MS, MS Lamito, absolute truth, there are these microorganisms. MS, relative truth to our senses, halachically they don't exist. As if they don't exist. Another example. We all know that the sun doesn't rise and the sun doesn't set. The earth turns and it appears like the sun is rising and setting. Didn't the Rabbanu Shlomo know that? He wrote in the Tanakh, Mizrach Shemesh Ad Mavo, from sunrise to sunset, all the calendars say, Neitzachama, Shkia Sachama. Didn't somebody tell these people that's not the case? But I'll tell you something. Last time I was in New York, I looked at the weather page on the New York Times, and it said sunrise AM and sunset PM. Hasn't anybody told the people of the New York Times that the sun doesn't rise and the sun doesn't set? What it should have said is earth turn morning, earth turn evening. The famous song, Sunrise, Sunset, should be earth turn, not sunrise, sunset. So the answer is that emes lamito, the sun doesn't rise and the sun doesn't set. But vis-a-vis our senses, the Rabbanu Shlomo wants us to see a sunrise and a sunset, and he wants us to relate to it as if it's sunrising and sunsetting. Even though we know absolutely it's not the case, but Lamaisa, that's how, there's no way in our senses that we can know that the earth's turning. So the Rabbanu Shlomo wants us to relate to it as if there's a sunrise and sunset. That is relative truth, even though the absolute truth is different. Same thing goes over here. Absolutely, absolute truth, every single thing that happens in this world is for the good. But the Rabbanu Shlomo didn't give us the ability to see it. He made us live in a time-related environment where we don't see the whole eternity. We see things based in time. And based in time, like we said, we see only a portion, and we don't see the good as good. We see sometimes the good is very, very painful, and very, very bad. And the Rebbeinu Shalom wants us to see it as painful. Why? Because that's part of the way that it's good. Sometimes a person needs to cry. They need to suffer. That's what the neshama needs in this world. That's the operation. And that operation, that suffering, that crying, whether it's for yourself or empathy for someone else, is what your neshama needs in order to be able to come to that good. So if the Rebbeinu Shalom made us see the good, we'd never have that benefit. So he wants us to see it as something that's painful. And he wants us sometimes to cry and to empathize and to sympathize. And that is the operation. That's what's good. And it's exactly like an operation. Person who knows that they need an operation, and they know that the operation will save their life, they're happy. They have satisfaction. They're crying. It hurts. It doesn't make it less hurt. It doesn't make it less reason to cry. But when they're crying and they're hurting, they know that there's a certain inner satisfaction that I'm crying and I'm hurting for a reason. It's all for the good. That doesn't make them click their heels, besimcha, and be rejoice over the operation. It hurts. They cry. But they know that the crying is for a purpose. That's what it means, l'kublinu besimcha. It doesn't mean to rejoice. It means to accept it with a satisfaction of knowing that there's a reason why you're suffering. There's a reason why you're crying. And understanding that, right, the Rebbeinu Shalom wants us to see it as bad. He wants us to cry. He wants us to absolutely know it's for the good. And that gives us a certain satisfaction that my suffering's for a purpose. It's not haphazard. It's not for no purpose. It's orchestrated by the Rebbeinu Shalom, and it's for my good ultimately. And I accept that. And I'm satisfied with that. But it still hurts. And therefore I'm crying. So you're supposed to cry. And you're supposed to say a dayin ha'emes with tears. At the same time, to have an inner satisfaction that if the Rebbeinu Shalom did it, it's for the good. Two levels. That is, in a nutshell, this inyan. There are many other ways of explaining it, many other ways of understanding it. I told you what seems to me understandable, at least to our small minds. And therefore, the more that we empathize and sympathize with the plight of someone that is very, very dear here. People who are big Bali Chesed, who have tremendous merit. And to ask the Rebbeinu Shel Olam that maybe there's another way to bring that good that doesn't have to be so bitter, but can be sweet. And if each and every one of us changes just a little bit as a schus, then perhaps, Mirtz Hashem, that will change the situation enough and in the right way to make the ending that we can see, a very, very happy ending. She should have a refuah shlema, b'sof shar chol Yisrael, lehena rasha, basita ratza, b'mheir of your name.